I cut my outboard and drifted onto the bank. 50 yards away, Cleet and Homer were anchored in a channel that flowed out of a bay between two narrow islands thick with gum and willow trees. They were casting their lures at the edges of the lily pads on the shady side of the islands. The time of day was equally wrong for big-mouth bass and sackalay and goggle-eye perch and bream, but catching fish wasn't the issue for Cleet. He had become Homer's father, and I didn't want to think about the travail and injury that awaited both of them. The sun was white in the sky, the surface of the bay gold and brown and wobbling with light, the breeze out of the south smelling of salt and distant rain. I went into the shade and propped an air cushion under my head and went to sleep. I dreamed of a scene out of T.E. Lawrence's The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, though I don't know why. Bedouins on camels and in open-air motor cars were charging down a sand dune, the early morning sun at their backs. Down below was a hospital train that had been dynamited and jacked off the tracks. The motor cars were equipped with Vickers machine guns, the muzzles flashing, sand rilling from the balloon tires. The train cars were filled with typhoid victims. The cries and moans of the dying were louder than the Vickers. I woke with a jerk, a weight like an anvil on my chest, pushing me into a dark pool.
"Hey," Cleet said, "you're having a dream. Wake up."
I held my head. I looked at my watch. I'd been asleep 15 minutes. I didn't know where I was.
"Must have been a whammeroo," Cleet said.
I looked at Homer and tried to shake the train from my mind. He had put on weight, the right kind. His hair was long and straight, mahogany-colored like an Indian's, his skin coppery, his eyes blue. I had the feeling he would be a tall boy, maybe a soldier, an underwater welder, a chopper pilot flying out to the rigs, but something out of the ordinary, something that required courage and paying dues. The restoration of his life was due to one man only, and that was Cleet Purcell. Homer was holding a huge mudcat on a stringer that was wrapped around his wrist.
"Is that yours or Cleet's?" I said.
"I caught it on throw line with a piece of liver," he said.
"You know how to skin one without getting spiked?"
"Yes, sir." I opened my Swiss Army knife and handed it to him backward. "I don't have no pliers," he said.
"Any pliers," Cleet said.
"Any pliers," Homer repeated.
"They're in the tackle box," Cleet said. "There's a nail on that gum tree by the water."
We waited until Homer was out of earshot.
"Something happened?" Cleet said.
I told him about the shooting at Labiche's house. He listened quietly, showing no expression. Then he said,
"It sounds like our guy lost his Kool-Aid. That is, if it's the nutcase who steals ice cream trucks."
"It's got to be the same guy. He just got sloppy."
"Like he's losing control?" Cleet said.
"That's my guess. Sherry Picard was at the house this morning."
"What for?"
"She didn't know where you were. She also said some cops and Jeff Davis want to screw you over."
"With the adoption?"
I nodded.
"Maybe this isn't just about some pinheads wanting to do payback," he said. "I've been making some calls about Nightingale. That bombing down in South America he told you about, did he give you specifics?"
"He said he didn't see the aftermath," I replied.
"I bet. There were more than 36 people maimed and blinded and killed. The government burned and bulldozed their village and moved them 200 miles away. Nightingale's family owned the company. Did he tell you that?"
"No."
"I'm going to fix him. I mean legit. I know a couple of wire service guys in New Orleans."
I didn't reply.
"That's not going to slide down the pipe," he said.
"How many people cared about the things you saw in El Sal?" He went to his boat and opened his cooler and took out 2 cans. He sat down next to me on the mound of compacted dirt and broken bricks.
"You were dreaming about Nam?"
"Not directly." He looked around at the cabins, the pools of heat in the corrugated roofs that had been added during Reconstruction, when the former Confederate colonel who owned Angola Plantation turned it into a rental convict farm to replace the slaves set free by the Emancipation Proclamation.
It's still with us, isn't it? He said.
What do I know? He put a cold can of Dr. Pepper in my hand.
Drink up, Big Mun. Let's take it to these motherfuckers, whoever they are.
High above us, a burnt orange pontoon plane was working against a headwind, frozen against a satin blue sky, droning like an angry bee. We got the ballistics back late Monday afternoon. The rounds fired in Labiche's home came from the same .357 used to kill the St. Mary deputy and the two drug dealers in Algiers. The same afternoon, Alifair came home in a huff from filming in the backyard of a plantation east of Jeanrette. I quit. Because of Nemo, I said. Along with his skanks and his low-life hangers-on. Good for you. But it's Levon who disappoints me, she said. You have to leave people to their own destiny, Alf. We were in the kitchen. She hadn't noticed Monty Coon sitting on the counter. When did this happen?
I fed him in the house a couple of times. Now he pops right in, just like Tripod. Snugs, our short-haired, thick-necked white cat, walked across the floor and joined Monty Coon on the counter with a thump.
Snugs' body rippled with muscle when he walked, his tail springing back and forth. His badges of honor were his chewed ears and the pink scars embedded in his fur. Alifair picked up Snugs and cradled him in her arms. She looked down into his face. Want to be a screenwriter? That's what I thought. You wouldn't touch Hollywood with your bare seat.
You told Tony Nemo or Levon you were through? I asked.
Both of them.
Nemo said something to you?
It's not important.
Yes, it is.
He said I'm lucky I'm beautiful because my books stink.
She focused her attention on Snugs and jiggled his tail. What else did he say?
Nothing. He's a fat idiot.
Tell me, Alifair.
He said, I bet you give good head.
I gazed out the window at the bayou, the shadows and spangled reflections of the sun that were like gold coins in the branches, the smoke from a barbecue pit in the park, the children playing among the camellia bushes. I need to pick up some milk at the store, I said.
Were you all filming in Albania plantation today? Why?
I just wondered. Is all the gang still there?
Leave it alone, Dave.
There's an open can of sardines in the icebox, I said. Why don't you treat these guys to a fine meal?
Jeanrette was a 15-minute ride back into the antebellum era, if that's what you wanted to look for. Albania Plantation was a magnificent place. The live oaks surrounding it were so large that the main house stayed in shadow throughout the brightest and hottest of days. Some of the original slave quarters constructed of logs were still standing. I parked my truck and walked around the side of the house. The backyard sloped down to the bayou. The film crew had turned the yard into the setting of a French cotillion when the year was 1862 and the Yankees had been whipped at both First and Second Manassas, and the lost cause was not lost at all. The trees were strung with paper lanterns. The actresses wore hoop dresses, and the actors wore the tailored steel-gray uniforms of the Army of Northern Virginia, many with silk sashes, and the band played the songs of Stephen Foster. The dying sun seemed to conspire with an Islamic moon and light the sky like a scene from 1001 Nights. The food and punch on the tables were real. Imaginary or not, the evening had become a tribute to a moment in history that would not come a-borning again. The people on the lawn seemed delighted with their departure from the 21st century. Tony Nemo was eating from a plastic bucket of potato salad at a picnic table behind the cameras and lights. He was talking to two women in their 20s, both with tats that covered the entire shoulder and trailed away like snakes down the arm. Their midriffs were exposed, their jeans form-fitting, although the denim looked soaked in black grease. Even before I went to Vietnam, there was a disorder in my head that I never understood. The catalyst, I suspect, lay in the unconscious. For me, the trigger always had to do with degradation of the body and the spirit, cruelty to animals or children, sexual assault, a man beating a woman, betrayal, lies that stole the faith of another. I would see colors rather than people or the environment around me. My words contained little meaning, as though they were written on water and not meant to be understood. My intentions, however, were obvious. Without warning, I would try to tear someone apart. I mean, break bones and teeth and sling blood onto the walls and leave the object of my rage with a reservoir of fear he would never forget. I never used a drop, but I owned half a dozen of them, taken from pimps, jack rollers, and smash-and-grabbers who turned over pawn shops. The serial numbers were acid-burned or ground off on an emery wheel. Sometimes the trigger and handles reverse taped so latents couldn't be lifted from the frame. They were a cop's get-out-of-jail card. They could have another purpose also. Tony never saw it coming. He looked up from his potato salad and started to smile, then realized who I was. The drop was a .22 revolver. The sight had been filed off. The metal was pitted. One wood handle was cracked in half. I held it behind my back, then shoved it into his mouth and cocked the hammer. I stared into his eyes without speaking. He was choking on his own saliva and the food he hadn't swallowed. The people sitting around him stared in horror. "Verbal abuse on a wrong young woman, Tony," I said. He gagged and tried to push away my arm. I pulled the trigger. His eyes almost came out of his head. I screwed the barrel deeper into his mouth and cocked the hammer again. I snapped it on another empty chamber. His throat was gurgling, his jowls trembling. The blubber on his chest and stomach was shaking like whale sperm. A woman was screaming. "Your odds are 1 in 4, Tony. Unless I put 2 rounds in the cylinder instead of 1, I can't remember." I pulled the trigger a third time. In the silence, a terrible whimpering sound rose from his throat. I removed the pistol from his mouth. Blood and saliva ran down his chin. He fumbled for his oxygen mask. I flipped out the cylinder and showed it to him. "No bullets, Tony. Here, see for yourself." His gaze lifted to my face. He looked like a man who realized a sea change had just taken place in his life, in full view of others, and he would never be able to erase the moment. I splashed the gun into his bowl of potato salad and walked back to my truck. I drove back down the highway and past a trailer slum and crossed the Tesh on a drawbridge and continued past another oak-shaded plantation within 100 yards of the slum property by the bridge. The juxtaposition of the two images could have been extrapolated from a Marxist propaganda film. I felt strange driving through the twilight by myself, as though I had deliberately severed my connection with the rational world and given up all pretense of normalcy, and in so doing had set myself free. Chapter 32. I wasn't done. I went to Levon Broussard's home on Lorville Road. His wife's car was in the garage, but his was not. I parked in front and waited. A few minutes later, his SUV turned off the road and came up the driveway. He got out and walked toward me, his engine still running. I could see Rowena watching from the gallery. "You crazy fuck," he said to me. "Problem?" "I saw it all. Approximately 150 other people did, too." "My daughter took the screenwriting job because she respects you and your work. Her faith was repaid by Nemo's insults and his attempt to degrade her. To my knowledge, you didn't do a damn thing about it."
"I didn't know about it."
"You do now."
"I'm supposed to kick him off the set? He's the goddamn producer."
I could feel my anger returning, my palms tingling, a dryness in my mouth, a flame inching its way across the lining of my stomach. "What's wrong with you, Levon? You've devoted your entire life to good causes. How could you hook up with a guy like Tony Nineball?"
"It's what the situation demanded.
You want him to rig a jury for you? He'll end up owning your soul.
I didn't kill Kevin Penny. A lot of people believe I did. Some have even congratulated me.
I stepped closer to him. I saw Rowena walk into the yard, a flowering tree in bloom behind her. Look me straight in the face and tell me you didn't do it, I said. Your prince wanted a drill only because you tried to save his life. Tell me that.
It's as you say.
There was not a flutter of emotion in his face or his eyes. He raped your wife. He put his mouth all over her body. He put his seed in her.
You want me to knock you down?
You don't like the imagery? What do you think your trial is going to be like?
Tell Alifair I'm sorry. Ask her to come back on the set.
Dream on.
What can I say?
The truth.
White Doves at Morning is one of my best books and one of the least read. I wanted to see it on the screen. Nemo obtained the funding. If I had gotten it myself, I would have ended up dealing with the same Hollywood people he deals with. When you get off the phone with them, you want to clean your ear with baby wipes.
Who killed Penny?
I didn't.
There's something you're hiding. I don't buy your story about the drill. It's too coincidental that you show up just after someone turns him into Swiss cheese.
You never mentioned Jimmy Nightingale or his sister, he said. He's headed for the Senate and maybe even bigger things. He's a fascist who's lying to all these poor people who think he's going to make their lives better. But you're worried about justice for the guy who raped my wife and maybe killed some of the Jeff Davis eight.
Seen any good movies? I said.
Fuck you.
I'll remember that, I said. But it wasn't over. Rowena walked across the grass to the edge of the driveway, wearing jeans and a beige T-shirt with paint on it and no bra.
Don't talk to him like that, Levon. Come in, Mr. Robichaux. Have some tea with us.
She lived up to her name, right out of Sir Walter Scott. You're a grand lady, madame, I said. All the best to both of you. On the way home, my cell phone vibrated in my pocket. I flipped it open. The caller was Melvin LeBlanc, the physician.
What's the haps, Mel? I said.
I'm at Iberia, General. The head nurse thinks you should get over here.
Regarding what?
Spade LeBiche. She says he keeps repeating the word robo. Mean anything?
I parked under the oaks in front of the hospital and went inside. A nurse walked with me to the ICU.
Is he a friend of yours, Detective?
We worked together.
I wondered if he had any immediate family in the area.
Maybe in New Orleans?
I see.
Why do you ask?
If he belongs to a church, this would be an appropriate time for his pastor to visit.
I went inside the room.
The left side of his face was encased in bandages except for the eye.
He was breathing through his mouth. His lips formed in a cone as though he had eaten hot food and was trying to cool his tongue.
It's me, Spade, I said. Dave Robichaux.
He seemed not to hear me. The fingers of his right hand twitched.
I'm sorry this happened to you, partner, I said. You got a bad deal.
No reply. No reaction. I looked over my shoulder. The nurse had gone.
You want to tell me something?
His fingers moved again, up and down, as though he were beckoning. I leaned over, my ear close to his mouth.
Tell me what it is.
His breath contained a stench like decomposition in a shallow burial or a body bag in a tropical country.
You.
You what? I said.
You want save.
His voice trailed off. The neurologist had told me his hearing was destroyed, but maybe that wasn't the case.
Give it another try, I said. Thortez. Seizure.
I took a Kleenex from a box on the nightstand and wiped his spittle from my cheek. I eased my hand under his and held it. If you can't do it, Spade, you can't do it. In your mind, just tell the man upstairs you're sorry for the mistakes you made. Don't worry about anything else. I thought his left eye had been blinded, but it looked straight into mine. His voice was hoarse and coated with phlegm, the words rising from his throat like bubbles of foul air.
Epilepsy. He was strangling. Something was in his throat. You tried to save him.
Go on. I felt his hand go limp in mine. Hang in there, Spade. Come on, bud. Don't slip loose. If you have attended the dying, you know what their last moments are like. They anticipate the separation of themselves from the world of the living before you do, and they accept it with dignity and without complaint, and for just a moment they seem to recede from your vision and somehow become lighter, as though the soul has departed, or perhaps because they have surrendered a burden they told no one of. I had brought nothing to record his words, but I didn't care. I owed Spade a debt and wanted to repay it. I removed my religious medal and silver chain from my neck and poured it into his palm and folded his fingers on it and placed his hand and arm on his chest. I walked down the corridor and ran to the nurse by the elevator.
Is everything all right, Detective Robichaud?
Just fine, I said.
Is he resting all right? It's time for his sponge bath. Then we'll be transferring him to hospice.
I think Spade will be okay, I said.
I'm sure he appreciated your visit. The poor man. What a horrible fate. It's funny the things they say to you, isn't it?
Pardon?
At the end, men usually ask for their mothers. But he asked for you. You must be very close.
I drove home and fixed a cup of café au lait in a big mug and sat on the back steps. Snugs flopped down on my lap, then sharpened his claws on the inside of my thigh. I set him down next to me and, like two old gentlemen, we watched a rainstorm march across the wetlands and let loose a torrent of hailstones that danced like mothballs all over the yard. Chapter 33. The storm continued through the night, filling our rain gutters with pine needles and leaves, flooding the yard and most of East Maine. The Tesh was high and yellow at dawn, lapping into the cane brakes and cypress knees along the banks, the sun pink and the sky strung with white clouds and patches of blue. The trees were dripping audibly and throbbing with birds. It was a grand way to start the day, in spite of all that had happened. Helen caught me at 8:06 a.m. in the corridor outside her office. Inside, Buona. Tony Nineball is upset? No, half of St. Mary Parish is. I walked ahead of her. She slammed the door behind us. What the hell were you thinking? He told Allifair she probably gave good head. Her face went dead. Her early days at NOPD were not easy. She was not only a woman, she was a bisexual woman. The cruelty and abuse by a detective named Nate Baxter set new standards. He ended up face down in a plate of linguine in a family restaurant on Canal. I'd do it over if I had to, I said. Fire me if you want. Nemo is a bucket of shit who should have been poured down the honey hole a long time ago. She sat behind her desk and picked at a thumbnail. This isn't about Nemo, I said.
Labiche died last night. The head nurse says you were there.
I was.
And you knew he died?
Yes, he died with his hand in mine.
And you didn't bother to call in? Or say what you were doing there? Or what he might have said before he caught the bus?
What he told me won't change anything, I said. I didn't have my recorder.
What did he say?
D'Artez was having an epileptic seizure and I tried to save him. There was something in his throat. That's about it.
Jesus Christ, that's why you dragged him out the window, she said. He had the plastic filter of a cigar lodged in his throat. That's it. Then I think Penny came up behind me and hit me with a rock or a chunk of concrete.
Labiche mentioned Penny?
No.
Nothing to suggest who might have sent Penny after you?
I believe it was Nemo.
You're probably right. This won't get you off the hook, though, will it?
I don't care what anyone else thinks.
She opened her desk drawer and took out my medal and silver chain and set them on the corner of her desk. A nurse brought this by about 15 minutes ago. She said you must have left it in Labiche's hand because nobody else was in the room with him. I picked up the chain and put it around my neck and dropped the medal inside my shirt. Thanks.
You're a piece of work, Pops.
In a seedy motel north of the Four Corners area of Lafayette, Chester Wimple sat on the side of his bed and stared at the window shade. The bottoms of his tennis shoes barely touched the floor. He wore a white painter's cap with a long bill and a high square top, and brand new pants that fitted his legs like buckets, and a stiff, short-sleeved, checked shirt, and a clip-on bow tie. When he tried to rethink the events in the Labiche house, his mouth and jaw contorted as though a puppeteer were playing a joke with his face. He had never messed up a hit, or left loose ends, or allowed emotion to sully the virtuous nature of his work. Tidiness and cleanliness were his hallmarks. The left hand of God could not be otherwise. The words, "creepy little snurd," crawled like worms in his ears. On the bedspread were his .357, a Scope 223 carbine, a Beretta 9mm, the earlier model with the 14-round magazine, and a World War II British commando knife, the blade double-edged, narrow, shining with an oily blue liquidity tapering into a dagger point. The steel was cold and hard when he picked it up and closed his palm on the handle, his lips parting, his phallus tingling inside his boxer shorts. This was the only weapon in his possession that had the personal touch that brought him into eye contact with the target and allowed him a guilty pleasure not unlike the impure thoughts he was not supposed to have. Yesterday, he had received a new set of index cards at the general delivery window. The drawings on each card and the names of the next targets caused him no difficulty. He did not know them or why they needed to be removed from the landscape, which, for Chester, was an antediluvian world governed by raptors and pterodactyls. The flowing calligraphy on the first card was the issue. The words seemed to contain a trap, the way words were used to trap him when he was a child. They made his eyes jitter, and the window shade changed from a warm yellow to a dull red that pulsed as though a fire were burning on the other side. The note read, "My dearest Chester, you have been a good boy. Don't ever let anyone say you are not. But I have the feeling you have been spying on me. You mustn't do this. We cannot be together again until our work is over. Please don't be offended. You know how much I love and care for you. You are the light of my life. Had we not had each other, we would not have survived. We'll be together soon. Just keep being the sweet boy you are, and stop these evil people from preying on our friends and children who cannot defend themselves." She had not signed the note, or even used an initial. He wanted to cry, not out of joy either. She did not want to see him. He pushed the point of the commando knife into the skin behind his chin, forcing his head back until his neck ached. What if he shoved the blade to the hilt? Could it reach the brain? What was the poem she used to read him? He could remember only pieces,
Tiger. Tiger. Burning bright. In the forests of the night. What the hammer? What the chain? In what furnace? What's thy brain? He had thought she was talking about him, and why he was different from other children. Oh, no, no, she said. You're a good boy, Chester. This poem is about bad people, the kind who have hurt us. At that moment, he knew no power on earth would ever separate them. He replaced the rubber band around the index cards and flipped through the images with his thumb. Two more targets, people he knew nothing about. What had they done? Actually, he didn't care. If they were on the cards, there was a good reason. They knew it, too. He saw the regret in their eyes before he sent them to that place where they couldn't hurt people anymore, and he felt no guilt about their passing. He gave ice cream to children with a glad heart. That's who Chester Wimple was. But something else was bothering him. He was losing his objectivity, and his motivations were becoming impure. For personal reasons, he wanted to do the man with the convex face and the peroxided shoebrush haircut and the muscles that glistened with suntan oil. The man in the pool with Emmeline Nightingale. The man whose body fluids floated in the water and touched hers. He wanted to do this man on his own, up close with a commando knife, or with a rifle from afar, so the soft-nosed, jacketed round would be toppling when it keyholed through the face, all of it caught inside the cylindrical simplicity of the telescopic sight. Chester turned on the television set and stared at cartoons for the next 2 hours, sitting on the side of the bed, his mouth open, his face as insentient as a bowl of porridge.
Cleet was not only a member of our family, he would lay down his life for Allifair or me, which also meant he inserted himself into situations without consulting anyone. On Tuesday, he and Homer went fishing in St. Mary Parish, then drove top-down to the movie set behind Albania Plantation. Levon and Rowena Broussard were standing behind a camera down the bayou. The actors and the crew were just breaking for lunch. Tony Nineball was nowhere in sight. Cleet removed his pork pie hat.
My name is Cleet Purcell, Mr. Broussard. Got a minute?
You don't have to tell me who you are, Levon said.
Cleet put his hat back on and looked at the bayou and the hundreds of robins in the trees.
This is my pal, Homer.
Homer Penny?
Levon said. Homer looked at his feet.
I'm his guardian, Cleet said. Unofficial, but guardian just the same. He's never seen a movie set.
Cleet could hear the wind in the silence.
How are you, Homer?
Rowena said and extended her hand. The scars where she'd cut herself were red and thick as nightcrawlers.
Dave and Allifair Robichaud don't know I'm here, Cleet said.
You're on a mission of mercy, Levon said.
I was an extra and did security on a couple of films but didn't have my name on the credits. I didn't think you'd mind. I mean, us being here and all.
Welcome, Levon said.
I wanted to ask a favor, too.
I never would have guessed, Levon said.
I have a frisbee over there on the table, Homer, Rowena said. Why don't you and I toss a couple?
Homer looked down the slope at a row of cannons and actors and kepis and butternut uniforms. That'd be great, he said. Levon waited until they were out of earshot.
You're here about Allifair.
She worked hard on the script, Cleet said. It wasn't for the money either.
What do you want me to do about it?
Tell her you want her back.
She can come back any time she likes.
That's not the same as apologizing for what happened and telling her you appreciate her work.
Levon took out his cell phone and found a number in his contacts. His call to Allifair went straight to voicemail.
This is Levon. Tony is a jerk. I need you here, Allifair. Your script is beautiful. I don't want amateurs messing it up. I sent you two emails. Call me. He closed his cell. Anything else?
I sent the Nightingale chauffeur to you, a guy named Swede Jensen. I hope you didn't mind.
He's a Confederate soldier. He's down by the bayou now.
No kidding, Cleet said.
I'd like to eat lunch and get back to work.
Sure, Cleet said.
Do you and Homer want to join us?
Cleet saw a red frisbee sail over the cannon and Homer jump in the air to catch it, his face split with a smile.
That'd be nice. That night the rain came again, mixed with hail and bursts of tree-lashing wind. Cleet ordered in a pizza, and he and Homer watched My Darling Clementine on Cleet's television set. At the end of the film, when Henry Fonda leaves the woman by the side of the road and rides away into the Arizona wastelands, Homer's eyes turned wet, and he looked at Cleet for an explanation, either for the film or for his emotions. See, it's about the fact that a guy like Wyatt Earp would never be able to enjoy a normal life, Cleet said.
Clementine is so beautiful, Homer said. You can see the love in her eyes. It's not right to leave her just standing by the road.
See, John Ford directed that film, Homer. He was always experimenting with light and shadow. The story is about good and evil. Even though all the clans are killed, Wyatt knows more of them are waiting out there in the wastelands. He's the guy who has to keep the rest of us safe.
So maybe he'll come back and see Clementine again?
You never can tell.
Later, as Cleet lay in the dark with the rain clattering on the roof, his own words brought him to conclusions about himself that he didn't want to face. He had two kinds of dreams, one in color, one in black and white. Sometimes in his sleep he returned to the French Quarter of the old days, when Sam Butera and Louis Prima were blowing out the walls at Sharky Bonanna's dream room on Bourbon, the balconies dripping with flowers along streets that seemed about to collapse in on themselves, the street bands playing for coins, and the sidewalk artists setting up their easels in Jackson Square. The black kids dancing with taps as big as horseshoes clamped on their feet. The smell of beignets and café au lait in the Café du Mans. The palms and banana fronds ticking inside the gated courtyards. The arched entranceways dank and cool-smelling. The stone stained with lichen and ponded with water that resembled spilled burgundy in the shadows. The dreams in black and white, went back to an Asian country where, out there in the sweltering dark, beyond the concertina wire and the claymores and the flicker of an offshore battery, Bedcheck Charlie launched grenades randomly with a captured Blucher, blowing mud, foliage, and even a sit-down shitter into the air, the detritus raining down on Cleet's poncho and steel pot. Occasionally, Bedcheck Charlie got lucky, and after the explosion, a grunt down the line would scream words at the stars that Cleet did not want to attach to an image. Sleep came to Cleet only by way of surrender to a fantasy. Before he went overseas, he saw a black-and-white news film in an art theater in San Fran that showed Viet Minh sappers crawling through barbed wire strung by French legionnaires. The Viet Minh wore sandals cut out of rubber tires and sweat-soaked black pajamas that looked like black oil on their skeletal frames. Their only possessions and weapons were a rice ball, a piece of fish tied in a sling on their waist, and a bamboo cylinder packed with explosives tied on their back. Without flinching, they crawled across anti-personnel mines that blew them into dog food. Yet they kept coming. Undaunted. Cleet wondered how desperate a person would have to be in order to become so brave. At about 0400, he would surrender to his fatigue, the eggs of a malarial mosquito humming in his blood, the sour stench of his body, the jungle ulcers on his skin,
The squishiness of trench foot inside his boots. The insects that got into his socks and up his legs. The cut on his nose where his steel pot had scissored down on his face. In surrendering, he put the faces of the sappers on Bedcheck Charlie, and for a brief time did not think of him as an enemy. Cleet gave himself over to a mental opiate, and Bedcheck disappeared into a box. Cleet never spoke to others of the private universe in which he lived, nor did he share his belief that the world was mad, that most politicians were liars who served the interests of corporations, that populists were con artists, and that the poor were kept poor and uneducated as long as possible. Sunrise brought heat and humidity that felt like fire ants crawling inside his utilities. The dawn also meant rice paddies filled with human feces and trails with poisonous snakes looped around tree branches and booby-trapped 105 duds and Vietnamese knockoffs of our M14 mines and bouncing Bettys that would steal your limbs and eyes or simply take you off at the waist and leave half of you to whisper your last words. In his dreams, he saw all of this in black and white, never in color, and he believed the phenomenon had something to do with the distinction between good and evil. The irony was that he had never learned where the difference lay. He woke with a start at 3:06 a.m., unsure where he was. He saw lightning outside and the silvery green slashing of an oak limb across the window. But it was not the storm that woke him. Just before waking, he had seen an image in his mind. An incandescent, worm-like creature whose heat was so bright and intense that it evaporated the rain and the darkness surrounding it. He took his snub nose from under his pillow and put on his slippers and unbolted and unchained the door and stepped out on the stoop in his pajamas, ignoring the rain. "Who's out there?" An electric light burned in a boathouse across the bayou. His caddy was parked in the cul-de-sac, the hood and cloth top sprinkled with leaves and pine needles, the hand-waxed paint job beaded with water. In the corner of his eye, he thought he saw a figure moving through the trees, away from the motor court. Cleet walked out on the gravel, rain running into his face, his pajamas sticking to his skin, the snub nose hanging from his hand.
"I saw you, pal. Come out, or you might catch one in the brisket."
No response.
"Hey, shit for brains, I know who you are," he said.
No answer or any movement in the trees.
"You're the guy they call Smiley," he said. "My daughter is Gretchen Horowitz. A fuck like you is lucky to do $100 hits in Little Havana."
None of it worked, and Cleet felt foolish talking to the rain. He walked through the trees to the water's edge, his slippers sinking in the loam. The bayou was the color of café au lait, wrinkling in the wind like shriveled skin. His hand was squeezed tight on the grips of the .38. Maybe he had imagined it all. There was no worm-like creature anywhere except in his mind, which for years had been a repository of weed and alcohol. He walked back to the cul-de-sac and his caddy, then saw the Slim Jim stuck solidly and abandoned between the driver's window and the door. Cleet reached under the back fender and removed the magnetized metal box that held his spare key and unlocked the passenger door and removed a small flashlight from the glove box. He went to the driver's side and shined the light on a few footprints that seemed inconsequential, then opened the car door with the key and searched the floor. Nothing. He pulled the Slim Jim from the window and began searching the ground. Again, nothing, or almost nothing. Just as he clicked off the light, he saw a glimmer in the grass. He clicked the light on again and stooped down and touched a small glass tube with the flashlight's case. It was a mercury tilt switch, probably homemade. He went back into the cottage and pulled off his pajamas and dried off with a towel and put on clean clothes and wrote a note for Homer. And then he tore up the note and sat in a stuffed chair and stared out the window until daylight, when the rain thinned into rings on the bayou and fog bumping in thick clouds amid the tree trunks. When he thought of the glass tube's implications, his shingles flared like a nest of heated wires between his shoulder blades, and the remnants of his undigested supper spilled into his mouth. Chapter 34. He pulled into my driveway at 7 a.m. when I was feeding Snugs and Monty Coon on top of Tripod's hutch. I fixed a pot of coffee and took it and two tin cups out to the redwood table in the backyard and filled our cups, waiting for him to explain why he had come to my door. Cleet's face was a complex study, particularly during times of crisis or decision. The more intense the emotion, the more silent and withdrawn he became. The pattern never changed. He breathed evenly through his nose, his green eyes fixed on a hologram no one else saw. The crow's feet at the corners of his eyes flattened and turned the color of papier-mâché, his forehead turning as cool as marble, the blood settling in his cheeks because it had nowhere else to go. "Had an early visitor this morning," he said, "in the middle of a storm." He hooked a finger through the handle on the cup. The coffee was black and scalding hot, a wisp rising from it like a trail of cigarette smoke. He drank from the cup a sip at a time, then swilled half of it, swallowing with no discomfort. "What happened?" I said. "Somebody tried to put a bomb in my car."
"You saw somebody around your car with a bomb?"
"I went outside before he could finish jimmying the window. He ran off."
"How do you know he had a bomb?"
"I found a tilt switch in the grass next to the driver's door."
He saw the confusion in my face.
"It's a glass tube that's got mercury in it. It's attached to the brake pedal or the accelerator. When the driver presses down on the pedal, the tube tilts and creates the electrical connection that detonates the charge."
"You saw the guy?"
"He took off. If I hadn't woken up, he probably would have killed me and Homer. We go down to McDonald's in the morning for biscuits and eggs."
"Do you have the tube?"
He nodded. "I think it's this guy Smiley. I told him that."
"We'll get everything to the lab."
"Waste of time. The guy's a pro. One of two guys sent him."
I knew where we were going. "You don't know it was Smiley. Don't start making connections."
"He's out-of-town talent. He's working for Fat Tony or Jimmy Nightingale. They both have the same motivation."
"Like what?"
"Tony thinks he's hit the big time in Hollywood. Nightingale is about to become an international figure. They're leaving their baggage in the depot." But I knew Cleet's thought processes had not reached their destination. "It's Nightingale," he said. "His shit prints are on all of this."
"Okay, he's the Antichrist of St. Mary Parish," I said. "You made your point. But the evidence that he's hired a killer isn't there. Tony Nemo hires killers. Rich guys like Jimmy hire lawyers."
"Jimmy?"
"Nightingale," I said.
"Right."
Cleet refilled his cup and wrapped his hand around it and lifted it to his lips and set it down without drinking.
"I didn't come here to tell you about my suspicions. You're my friend, and I got to be up front with you about something."
I felt the moisture in my mouth dry up, even the taste of the coffee disappear.
"The guy who sent the bomber after me didn't care if he killed Homer or not," Cleet said. "It doesn't matter. If it's Tony Nineball or that punk in St. Mary Parish, the guy behind this is going off the board."
"I didn't hear that. You didn't say it. That thought never crossed your mind."
"I'm going to cap him, Streak."
I took the tin cup from his hand and threw the coffee on the ground. "We're done."
"What would you do if it was Allifair?" he said. "Think about it. What would you do?"
Late that night, a pizza scooter pulled into the driveway of a rented 19th-century home outside Jeanrette, and a short man in a stiff hat with a big bill got out with a pie box and looked around as though unsure of the address. The house was set back from the street and dark with shadow except for a light in the bathroom. A tall figure walked out of the driveway and confronted the delivery man. There was a brief exchange, then the tall figure disappeared, and the delivery man climbed the steps to the gallery and twisted the bell. The man who answered was wearing a brocaded royal blue silk robe. His body was shaped like a pile of inner tubes.
What's this?
Your pizza.
I didn't order pizza!
The delivery man looked at the bill in his hand.
Anthony Nemo?
The name is Tony! I didn't order pizza! Where's Robert?
Who?
My chauffeur.
He's sleeping.
You leave your flying saucer on the lawn?
He was tired. He went to sleep. Like you.
The delivery man raised a stun gun and touched it to the center of Tony Nineball's face. Tony hit the floor like a cargo net loaded with salami. When Tony awoke, all the curtains were closed, the air conditioning blasting out Arctic levels of cold air. A toy man, with lips as red as a clown's, was sitting on a chair 2 feet from him, staring at him with a silly smile. Tony's arms were pulled behind him.
"Hi, sweepyhead," the man said. "My name is Chester. Do you want some pizza?"
"I can't move."
"You have ligatures on, so you won't hurt yourself."
"You almost knocked my head off. I can't breathe. I got emphysema."
Chester went into the bedroom and came back with a pillow. He put it under Tony's head.
"Better?"
Tony's eyes were small and black and buried deep in his face.
"You sound like Elmer Fudd."
"Don't be impolite. I can make you go back to sleep."
"You're the whack job everybody is talking about."
Chester removed a rolled comic book from his back pocket and tapped it on Tony's nose.
"Bad, bad, bad."
"You're nuts! You belong in a gerbil cage! Tell me what you want!"
"Don't make me mad."
"My dick in your mouth, jerk off! I got guys out there gonna take you apart no matter what happens in here."
"No nasty talk. Not one word."
Chester tightened the comic in his grip and hammered the butt end on Tony's nose. Tony's face went out of shape, his eyes watering. A sound like a punctured tire wheezed from his throat.
"I got to have my tank."
"Bad boys don't get what they want. I did some research on you. You have been very bad."
"What the fuck is this?"
"Did Kevin Penny work for you?"
"So what?"
"He was cruel to his little boy. You knew about it. You didn't stop it."
"I didn't know nothing about his personal life. You're here from Boys Town?"
Chester's head was throbbing like wooden blocks falling down a staircase.
"I wasn't in Boys Town. I was in a place where bad things were done to me."
"From what I hear, you already fucked up 2 hits. One with a cop in New Iberia, one with Cleet Purcell. Kevin Penny's kid is living with Purcell. You were supposed to blow up the kid, too. You looking for child abusers? Go look in the mirror, gerbil boy."
Chester's mouth had shrunk to a stitch, his nostrils no more than tiny holes, white around the rims. He unrolled his comic book and stared at the cover. Wonder Woman was leaping across a canyon undaunted, her gold and red bodice pushing up her breasts, her blue star-spangled shorts skin tight, the message in her face unmistakable. "I will," Chester said inside his head.
"You'll do what?"
Tony said.
What Wonder Woman tells me to. If I don't, I'll have bad thoughts and do bad things.
Bad thoughts? You're an assassin who talks to a comic book. You're a meltdown. I can get you help for that.
Chester rolled the comic into a tight cylinder again and jammed it as hard as a stick into Tony's eye.
You will not talk back anymore.
Tony's face quivered with shock. His wounded eye was watering and rimmed with a red ring.
I never did anything to you. Somebody's using you. I'm a businessman, a movie producer. Check me out. You want to be in a movie? I'll put you in a movie.
You need to be punished.
What do you call this?
Nothing,
Chester said. He went outside and returned with a black leather bag, the kind physicians once carried. He removed a pair of needle-nose pliers and a plastic container. Tony's face seemed to shrink and become miniaturized.
Don't!
Chester unscrewed the cap and fitted the pliers on Tony's nose and squeezed.
Open wide.
Then he poured the container of Drano down Tony's throat, making sure not to get any on his clothes or hands. The next morning, Helen called half a dozen plainclothes into her office. She was looking out the window at the Tesh as we filed in. When she turned around, it was obvious that she planned to be brief and deliver a message that cops understand but don't talk about. The coroner says Nemo went out about as hard as it gets. His chauffeur is still in a coma. A passerby said he saw a man in a box-like hat get out of the delivery wagon and talk to someone in the driveway. The someone was probably the chauffeur. He got his eggs scrambled with a stun gun. The pizza wagon was stolen. Maybe it's our man Smiley, maybe not. The homicide is under the jurisdiction of St. Mary Parish.
That's it, someone said.
It's my belief that the same guy tried to put a bomb in Cleet Purcell's car, she replied. Or maybe we've got a tag team at work. Whoever it is, we need to cool him out. Everybody hearing me on this? We don't get hurt. Civilians don't get hurt. Bad guys go out of business. Everybody copy? There was a collective, yes, ma'am. You stay, Dave, she said. She waited until everyone else had gone. There was a solitary red rose and a slender glass vase on her desk. This is eating my lunch. Don't let it, I said. We've got a guy killing people all over Acadiana, and we don't know his name. We don't have prints or weapons. All we have is two casings from the Cajun Dome that were wiped clean. Nobody is that good. Nothing more from the feds? They've heard of a guy working out of Miami named Smiley. They don't know any more than we do. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place, I said. Maybe he's from overseas. The mob used to bring hitters in from Sicily. They'd stay with a local family, wash the dishes, do the hit, and go back home. She tried to straighten the rose in the vase, then picked up a petal that had fallen on the desk and dropped it into the wastebasket. Her eyes seemed out of focus. That's a pretty flower, I said.
The fella gave it to me for my birthday. The fella I might start seeing.
I had no idea why she was behaving the way she was. You okay, huh? There was a worm right in the middle of the rose. Funny, huh? I knew better than to say anything.
It's like Smiley, she said. He's out there, invisible, always ready to do harm.
He's just a guy, nothing more. She sat back in her chair, her gaze receding.
You know better.
I wasn't going to pursue the subject. I had known Red Cross personnel and American soldiers who had been at the liberation of Ravensbrück and Dachau. None of them was ever the same again. They also spent the rest of their lives trying to explain the nature and sources of evil. Cops fall easily into the same trap. A day comes when you see something that you never talk about again, and it lives with you the rest of your days. We'll get him, I said.
I'm not talking about Smiley or whatever his name is.